It's about 3 kilometers away on about a 45 degree angle from the position of the hive in relation to the sun. A true form of sign language. God invented it first. Now, of course, God invented navigation capability first and gave it to amazing navigators, birds, and we now know it's pre-programmed precision navigation programmed into their DNA. We know this because often the parent birds will leave the young fledglings before they're mature enough and have enough body fat for fuel, and they'll fly thousands of miles away and just abandon their young. But as soon as the young are old enough and mature enough to make the flight, they take off and fly over thousands of miles of never before seen land and sea and get to the same tree where their parents are, 4,000 miles away. How do they do that? Well, they have absolute precision navigation capability. They use the sun, they use magnetic compasses, they use clocks to determine longitude. But what's really amazing is we have found, of course, this also is resident in the pinhead-sized brain of the longest migrating insect in the world, the monarch butterfly. Monarch has the ability to use the sun as a means of determining direction, except for the fact the sun appears to move across the sky as the Earth rotates on its axis, so it has to automatically compensate for that. Excuse me. Also, it has the equivalent of a sextant in little slits in its antennae that allow it to measure accurately the precise distance of the sun above the horizon. Now, if you get this astronomical input and you have a pre-digested data in a navigator's almanac, mathematical formulas, you have a built-in biological calendar to tell you the season and the month and the date of the year, if the sun rises on a certain azimuth and gets a certain height on a certain day of the year, that tells you something about where you are on the globe of the Earth so far as latitude is concerned. And it has the ability to do all that in its pinhead-sized brain. But you need more than that. You have to determine longitude. And that could be done if you have accurate clocks. In fact, that was a big problem for man for centuries. Nobody had invented a clock that worked at sea. The old days, you know, they had pendulum clocks like a grandfather clock where you put that on a rocking, rolling ship and it doesn't work. So they had to invent the spiral watch spring that you wind up in a marine chronometer that would give you accurate time, and that's used to determine longitude. So you have local time, accurate clock that tells you that on that particular day, and standard meridian time, the time at zero longitude. You subtract to find the difference in minutes between these two clocks, then you take that number and divide by a certain number, and that will give you your longitude. Does anybody know what number you divide by? Well, too bad, so sad for you. You're all going to drown in the ocean trying to find little islands. You know, the Monarch takes off over 1,300 kilometers out over the Atlantic Ocean that's never seen in its life and finds the tiny little Bermuda Islands, which aren't very big. You have to be able to determine your longitude and latitude where you are and take the right trajectory from your position to intercept those islands. And you got to know what you're doing. You got to know your math. But all that is done in the little supercomputer pinhead-sized brain that God gave to these monarchs. Now then, if it's cloudy and foggy, it can still keep on direction using magnetite in its brain, which allows it to orient to the Earth's magnetic field. And then when the sun comes back out, it can get more precise astronomical computations to consider to continue precisely. But even all of this and the ability to use it is worthless unless you have something else. What else do you need? Something very important. You have to have an accurate map of the Earth. How in the world did an accurate biological map of the Earth get put in that little pinhead-sized brain? You see, it's not enough to have a map, which can be hard enough to explain how in the world that got there, but it has to be accurate. You know, when you go on a vacation someplace you've never gone before, you always make sure, prior to the days of GPS especially, you take a map, because it's going to tell you where things are that you've never been to before and you don't know where you're going. But what if the map is inaccurate? What if it's put together by a bunch of blind, random, destructive mutations in the DNA code? And so you compute your longitude and latitude, where you are in North America, you take off on the right trajectory to intercept the Bermuda Islands, and you get there and there's nothing. Far as the eye can see, no islands. What's the problem? Well, you did all this part right, but you had an inaccurate map because it was put together by a bunch of accidental mistakes in your DNA code, and you drown. You run out of fuel and drown. This, of course, is a problem of irreducible complexity. It either all works together or it doesn't work at all. And that's impossible for evolution to explain. It needs step by step over ages of time. But you fly out over the ocean, you better have all this working first time every time or you die and go extinct. But monarchs haven't gone extinct. Somebody put all that amazing capability in their DNA. I don't think it was a bunch of blind accidental mutations. Now then, here we have shock absorbers, which work pretty good on cars, but sometimes we have delicate electronics that have to undergo extreme shock forces, high G forces, and a G is what you feel pulling yourself down in your chair, 1G, 1 times the force of gravity. However, sometimes we have delicate electronics that have to go through extreme shock, and somebody figured out, let's ask the biomimetic question. If we need to package delicate computer chips to withstand extreme forces, which often they do in the military especially, how can we do that? And somebody said, well, that problem has been solved in nature with the woodpecker. We now know that the woodpecker endures up to 1,200 Gs of force, hundreds of times a minute, at the speed of a submachine gun. Now, to put that in perspective, if you're near a grenade, not even a grenade that has shrapnel, just a pure concussive grenade, and that concussive blast hits you and it equals at least 100 degrees of force, 100 Gs of force, you're dead. No human can withstand that. But this bird goes through 1,200 Gs, hundreds of times a second, without breaking its bill, cracking its skull, and turning its brains into mush. It's got some pretty good protection. So they analyzed it, and they found four different areas that were shock-absorbing features in the skull and beak of the woodpecker. Excuse me. And they tried to emulate that, and it turned out pretty good. It actually protected their electronics, but they got the idea from studying God's design. Now then, the Wright brothers are rightfully credited with being the first ones to create a heavier-than-air aircraft that could be powered and controlled. Prior to that, they had made balloons and dirigibles that are lighter than air. But in what year did they actually do this? Anybody remember their history? 1903, well over 100 years ago now. But obviously, the Wright brothers weren't the first ones to figure out how to make a flying machine. God did it first on day five with the birds. And the Wright brothers studied the birds to try to get the right aerofoil design for their own Wright flyer. But God did it four different times and four different classes of creatures. Not just birds, but also, well, see if we can get this thing to work here. Oops, I'm going a little too far. Also, flying mammals, the bats. Flying insects, the amazing dragonfly, and the so-called extinct flying reptiles or pterosaurs. Although if you ever talk to missionaries from Papua New Guinea and ask them, have you seen flying reptiles? They'll say, yes, but I don't tell anybody because I think I'm insane. And they've been seen in the southwestern United States, so keep your eyes open. Anyway, this amazing creature here, the four-winged dragonfly, can dart about so quickly, they estimate it undergoes 30 Gs of force without killing itself, without passing out and crashing. That's amazing, because the toughest fighter pilots with a G-suit on to help them can only pull about 9 or 10 Gs for just a matter of seconds, and then they pass out and crash. So how did God do this? Well, we'll look at that a little bit later. Now then, hovering flight took a little bit longer. It took the invention of the helicopter to be able to hover and fly backwards if you wanted to, but God beat them to the punch with the amazing hummingbird. Oh yes, if you ever seen hummingbirds during mating season or protecting their nests, they can zoom and dive and do things that would make a helicopter green with envy. Anyway, even more spectacular, oops, get the right one here. Yep, going the wrong way, there we go. Okay, even more spectacular is again that four-winged dragonfly, which can do maneuvers even more amazing than the hummingbird. We'll see how it does that a little bit later. Now, gliding flight is not powered flight, but it's something man invented before he invented powered flight, but again, God beat them to the punch. Here we have the great granddaddy of the hang glider, and these actually worked, you know, back in the 1800s. And they also have the non-powered glider that the Wright brothers made to test out the aerodynamic principles of their Wright flyer. So they built a glider first, and it worked well, but God built gliders first. He built the flying fish, which is a little bit of a misnomer because it doesn't really flap its fins to fly. It just builds up speed in the water, jumps into the air, especially if it's being chased by predators, it goes pretty fast, jumps in the air, deploys these big fins, which are actually shaped aerodynamically like aerofoils for lift, and it can glide. They can glide quite a bit of distance, but they don't glide real high. So if you're fishing in tropical waters, watch out, you might get beamed in the head with the flying fish because they fly and they don't usually maneuver too well. Okay. Now also the flying squirrel, a mammal. And today we have, what do the skydivers use to help them glide long distance? It's called a squirrel suit. Yeah, who did they copy? God's design. God made it first. Okay. Now, George de Mestral, a Swiss electronics engineer, he has invented something that probably everyone in this room has used, but it's not an electronic product. Well, being of a scientific mind, when he took his dog out walking for hikes, he was amazed at how burrs would stick in his socks and pants and in the dog's fur. And so he took out his microscope, he looked at it, and he could see all these little hooks. And they thought, that gives me an idea. What if we had strips and we put hooks on one side and loops on the other? Why, we would have what we today call Velcro. But the inspiration came from the design of the burr, a design already existing in the world of biology. Now here we have a artificial lure. This is not a real fish, not real bait. It's designed to look rather like a fish, and it has this little device on the front to make it wiggle as it's being trolled, so it looks like it's swimming like a fish. And it looks good enough that it fools the fish. The fish try to bite on it, and of course, they end up getting reeled in because it is an artificial lure. But even fishing with artificial lures is not something that man invented first. God invented it first with the appropriately named angler fish. The angler fish has a movable wand on his back, and at the end, it has cells that produce bioluminescent light. This is an oxidative process that's very efficient, very little heat. Most of our lights give off more heat than they do visible light spectrum, so they're rather inefficient. But bioluminescence uses the biological compound luciferin and an enzyme, catalytic enzyme luciferase, to produce an oxidative process that produces cold light that's very efficient. Now, that part is illumined. The anglerfish lives so deep down in the sea, it's dark. It's like total darkness. So all that can be seen is that little worm-like thing dangling right in front of his mouth, and when another fish comes to grab that worm, it goes right in the mouth of the anglerfish. So God was the first one to invent fishing with an artificial lure. Now, solar power is all the rage today, but the concept of taking solar energy and converting it into a more useful form of energy, which in our technology, of course, is electricity, that concept is nothing new. God created that on day three when he created plants. Plants were the first ones to have solar panels. They're called leaves. And they use a very complex photosynthetic mechanism involving the Calvin cycle to produce chemical energy, convert solar energy into chemical energy sugars that can be used for plants and ultimately power almost all of the biological world. Almost all the biological world, including you and I, are indirectly powered by solar energy because we eat plants or eat animals that ate plants, goes down the food chain, but ultimately the power comes from the sun. God was the first one to have the idea of using solar energy and converting it into another more useful form. His mechanism, however, is so complex that if we started with the basic chemical agents, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, etc., and tried to put together just this one part of a plant cell, a chloroplast, it would be beyond our technological capability. God did it first. He was the first one to have the idea. Now, mirrors are something that man struggled with for a number of centuries. Man struggled just with getting clear glass. Clear back in the days of the Apostle Paul in the Roman Empire, they had glass, and we have all kinds of glass artifacts in museums today, but they're always kind of foggy and opaque, because back then they hadn't figured out how to make the right chemical recipe to make glass clear. But by the time of the Renaissance, they had figured that out. And if you take clear glass and put a nice silvery backing on it, you get a very good optical quality mirror. By the time of Sir Isaac Newton, they had good enough optical quality mirrors that he decided to invent a new type of telescope, the reflector telescope that uses a big concave mirror instead of an objective lens as the main means of magnification. And it actually bears his name to this day. It's called the Newtonian telescope. But long before man had invented good optical mirrors and good enough for telescopes, God had invented optical quality mirrors first. We find them in the eyes of shrimp and lobsters and a certain fish. The fish is called the spook fish, and it has compound eyes that see both up and down at the same time, two compound eyes on each side. I think it's called the spook fish because it spooks so easily. You can't approach it from any direction without it seeing you and getting spooked off. So it has virtually 360-degree awareness because of these eyes. So images coming from the top come through a conventional eye. Images from the bottom, however, are focused off of a concave optical mirror onto a separate retina. Now in the cross-section, we see images from the top are focused by this lens here onto this red pigment down here. That's actually the retina. You have a separate retina here for images coming from the bottom. They're actually focused off this concave optical quality lens that's not a lens, it's a mirror. And it focuses the image there. Both retinas are connected to an optical nerve that goes to the brain. So it's getting information from four eyes simultaneously. You know, if you wear glasses, sometimes they call you four eyes. Well, the spookfish is the original four eyes, and he has an amazing brain that can process all this. But it shows, again, God invented it first, optical quality mirrors. Now, sonar really came into its own during World War II, and this, of course, is the concept of echolocation. You send out strong sound waves that bounce off a target. The reverberating sound waves are then analyzed to determine the distance, the depth, and the bearing, or the direction that the target is moving. But long before man invented sonar and used it effectively first in World War II, God had invented it first. He invented it with amazing bats. Bats have far more amazing sonar than we have. They can fly around on a moonless night and chase after little no-see-ums, which means even in daylight you can't see them. They can see it with sonar and catch them in their mouths, far more precise than our sonar systems. God also gave this ability to certain marine mammals, most notably the dolphin. The dolphin has these powerful muscles in its nasal sacs that powerfully contract and produce clicking sounds that are focused through a fatty lens, a lens that actually focuses sound waves. It's called a sound melon, and it has unique lipids, or fatty acids, that are used to make this special fat, and it focuses on the target. Then the reverberating sound waves, the echoes, come back, and they're picked up by, again, special lipids, fats in the lower jaw, and that goes right up to the brain and goes into its computer brain, which then analyzes, just like our ships do, depth, bearing, direction, all these things that are needed to intercept the target. In fact, this is so accurate, they've done tests where in murky water where you can't really see, they throw in, say, nickels and quarters, just throw them in there. The dolphins are trained to go after the quarters, pick them up in their mouths, and ignore the nickels. So there's not much difference between the two, but they can tell the difference by sound alone. Amazing system, God invented it first. Now here, we have an old paddle wheeler boat. These are used for nostalgic cruises. They're not used on commercial cruise lines or commercial cargo vessels because they're not that efficient. It was the best they could do in the early days of steamships, but somebody invented in the later 1800s the screw propeller, which is more like a screw that spins this way, and all of the blades of the screw propeller are underwater and engage the water all the time. Whereas with your paddle wheel boat, only a few of the blades are actually hitting the water. Most of them are in the air and just wasted in that sense. So this is a far more effective design. In fact, the man who invented it took out his little boat in New York Harbor and he exceeded the speed limit. You know, so the harbor police came after him with their paddle wheeler boats and he just ran circles around them all day. They couldn't begin to catch him. He obviously had invented a superior technology, but God beat them to the punch. God invented a true rotary propulsion system long before man did. From the beginning of creation, God had invented the world's tiniest submarine with the world's tiniest rotary propulsion system. It is found in the E. coli single-celled bacterium. It has 40 different complex protein parts, and it is amazingly powerful, it's amazingly resilient, and it is amazingly efficient. Howard Berg of Harvard University said this is the most efficient engine known to exist in the universe. Far more efficient than anything we've been able to create ourselves. If you have a great big SUV or a pickup with a V8 engine, you might get somewhere between 8 to 12% efficiency out of that engine. In other words, how much useful work you can get out of it compared, you know, to what's in a gallon of gas, how much you actually get out of it, you know, 8 to 12%. If you've got a really good economy car, maybe somewhere between 30 to 40%. The best efficient engines we have are electric, and Tesla, who makes an electric car, recently was bragging that they came up with an electric engine that they claim has 75% efficiency. Wow, that's really good. Other engineers looked at it and said, well, we only get 68% out of that design. So maybe they're fudging a little, I don't know. The point is, this machine gets something like 99.97, something like that, I mean, almost 100%. We have nothing that can approach that level of efficiency. No machine can actually attain 100% efficiency because there's a law in physics that makes that impossible. That is the second law of thermodynamics, which states that when any work is done, some of the available free energy that can be harnessed for useful work is dissipated into an unusable form of energy called entropy. So it's usually heat that dissipates and can no longer be harnessed. So that happens with all of our engines, but with this one, you get nearly 100%. There's nothing like it that we know of in the universe. Not only is it incredibly efficient, it is also incredibly powerful. This thing can rotate at up to 100,000 RPMs down here. It has some kind of reduction gear in the shaft here so that the twisted filament that acts like propeller blades and, you know, has a true rotary propulsion system, it doesn't rotate quite that fast. But it does mean it can go very fast in relation to its size. Now, when things are very tiny, like a microscopic cell, you don't measure their speed in miles per hour. You measure it in how many body lengths they can go through in 1 second. How many of their own body lengths could they go through in 1 second? Now, when this thing gets excited, it's been clocked at up to 65 body lengths per second. That's really moving. Now, how can we relate to that? So you take that little microscopic bacterium and you blow it up until it's as big as a 20-foot long mini electric submarine, okay? And its electrical engines could then propel that thing 65 of its body lengths in 1 second. If you go 65 times 20 feet in 1 second, how fast are you going? In excess of Mach 1, the speed of sound, which is 750 miles an hour at sea level. And it's actually a bit faster than that. Now, jets do that in the air, but this is going through the water. You know, a submarine going through water, water is much denser than air, it's a lot more resistance, and yet it can go the equivalent of that speed if we raised it up to the size of a 20-foot mini submarine. And even that is not an adequate analogy, because when you're this tiny, you know, microscopic cell, the water molecules themselves are relative to that size much bigger. In other words, they're bigger, thicker, harder to get through, and therefore it would be more like having a 20-foot mini submarine that could plow through peanut butter at greater than the speed of sound. That's pretty powerful. So that's what we've got here. And not only that, it can be spinning 100,000 RPM and it smells some food behind it. It goes, ah, there's food back there. And it stops in 1/4 turn, immediately reverses, goes 100,000 RPM in the opposite direction without ripping itself apart. Now imagine going down the freeway at 75 miles an hour. Oh, I missed the exit. That's okay. I don't need to slow down or anything. I'll just shift it in reverse. Yeah, yeah. You'll slow down real quick, you know, and you won't be going anywhere fast till the tow truck comes. So this has amazing efficiency, power, speed. It has amazing resilience. It's been studied for decades. Millions of dollars have been invested trying to figure out how we might copy some of this amazing technology. But the scientists say that the one thing we know absolutely for sure about it is that blind, random, accidental mutations put the thing together in the first place. Really. Well, we've got 40 complex protein parts. You take just one of those parts out of there, the system doesn't work. Much like in our own technology, in a machine, all the parts are interdependent. They have to work together. You take out one part and the other parts may be good, but they can't cooperate, and therefore the system as a whole is inoperative. You can have all the parts in your car engine, but say the fuel pump is defective. Doesn't matter that all the other parts are there and they work. You're not going anywhere until you replace that fuel pump. So the problem is this thing needs motility. It has to move around to find food, otherwise it starves to death. So no motility means extinction. Now, if it evolved 39 of these parts, and each protein part is so complex with trillions of years of time and chance, it could not have evolved. We can argue that mathematically very easily. How do you get that last part? Otherwise, you die. It's kind of like being stuck out in the desert. You drive way out into the desert, run out of gas, and you realize, oh my gosh, I'm already dying of thirst. I can't walk out fast enough to keep from dying from thirst. If I don't find a car, I'm gonna die. You stumble on a dirt road. Here's a car. Oh my goodness, somebody left the keys in it. You turn the key. Nothing happens. You raise the hood. All the parts appear to be there, but oh, you can see somebody smashed the distributor cap. Well, you could say, gee, maybe if I wait long enough, a new distributor cap will evolve and then I can get out of here. No, you need it right now or you die. That's the problem we face in biology, irreducible complexity. It's not window dressing. It's absolutely required. And you get everything working together at the same time or it doesn't work at all. And if it doesn't work, you're dead. Evolution cannot explain these type of situations. Only creation can explain it. How did all those things get there, by the way? when these things reproduce, there is a genetic blueprint that tells exactly the specifications, the size, and the tolerances of these parts, what order they're to be built in, how they're to be put together. It's read by the equivalent of computerized robots that can read this language, translate it into another language called RNA, and then translate it into a third language, the language of function and structure, which is proteins. So you have a blueprint that somebody wrote that tells pre-programmed robotic molecular machines what to do because they can read the blueprint and follow the instructions and build it to an exact tolerance in the sequence that it's meant to be built. Where in the history of the world have we seen anything like that happen without intelligent design? It doesn't happen any other way. And all they have to do is give an example, and they'd be equal to us. No, we can prove in any laboratory any day of the week, intelligence produces information like blueprints. Intelligence produces complex computerized robots that can read information and follow instructions and build things. It doesn't happen any other way as far as science is concerned. Now then, when we look at the cross-section, we can see it has the true functions of an electric motor, except it uses a different type of charged particle. Electrical motors use the flow of electrons, which are negatively charged particles. This uses the flow of positively charged particles called protons or hydrogen ions. Metabolic processes build up the flow of these hydrogen ions, and they run through that thing like a water wheel and spin it at up to 100,000 RPM. Just like the principle of an electric motor, but using a different type of charged particle. God invented it first. Now here we have the AH-64 Apache attack helicopter, very effective against the terrorists in the Middle East. This is the most recent version, has a radar dome on top there, and it's called the longbow because it can hide behind buildings or trees or cliffs, and just the mast is exposed, and it can target with radar miles away and fire Hellfire or Griffin missiles to take out the terrorists. It has targeting pods on swivels in the front that give optical as well as infrared sensing. So even at night, when you don't have the visible spectrum of light, the heat signature, the infrared signature is picked up, and people look like they glow with their body heat. Very, very effective if you look on YouTube. But man was not the first one to invent what is called FLIR. FLIR is an acronym for forward-looking infrared. God invented FLIR first and gave FLIR pods to certain animals, snakes of all things. Here we have the forward-looking infrared pods on a python, and here they are on the rattlesnake. In tests, they've taped over the eyes of the snake so they can't see at all. Then they'll poke the snake with a stick to agitate it. Then they'll move the stick around in front of it, and the snake can tell the difference in the infrared signature of the stick in the background well enough that it can hit that stick just as if it were able to see in daylight. It's a very effective system, but God invented it first. Now, here we have a decoy duck. Not terribly great technology, although nowadays they're a little more sophisticated. They're not just wooden and paint and anchored. They actually have motors, so they're on a tether and they can actually move around like they're swimming. They can actually look like they're flapping their wings. They can have a duck call built into them so they sound like they're quacking. You know, the hunter doesn't have to do his own duck call. The decoy can do it. So animated decoys are used for what? To make the ducks feel, oh, these ducks down there sound like they're having a wonderful time swimming around. There must be food down there. They're not being molested or hassled by hunters, so it must be safe. So we'll fly down and join them. And of course, when they're lured into the appropriate range of the hunter's guns, they become duck soup. Now, this is not something man invented first. God was the first one to have the idea of an animated decoy to lure a creature in close that ordinarily will not come in close. And he put this decoy on, of all things, the back of a freshwater clam called the Lampsilus. Why does this clam mount on its back something that looks all the world like a little minnow, a little fish? It has an eye like a fish, head like a fish, body like a fish, fins like a fish, tail like a fish. And it even moves like a fish, looking like it's trying to swim against the current and hold its own against the current of the stream. Why does this freshwater clam need such an exquisite animated decoy? Because if it doesn't, it won't be able to reproduce. It has to lure fish in close in order to reproduce, and ordinarily they don't come in close because clams have a hard shell and fish can't eat them. They ignore them. So you got to get them to be lured in with a decoy. What does it look like? Well, there it is. It has the eye of a fish, body of a fish, fins and tail, and it moves, like it's trying to swim against the current. Now, of course, predatory fish will ignore a clam, but if they see that, they're going to go, oh, there's a tasty morsel. They come in close to eat the decoy, and somehow, electrically we think, the clam detects the exact position of the fish, and it squirts its tiny larvae into the mouth of the fish. These larvae have little hooks that attach to the gills of the fish and extract nutrients from the bloodstream until they grow into tiny little clams that then fall off on the bottom of the stream and embed in the mud and grow to adult clams that then mount their own animated decoys so they can reproduce also. This is a big problem for evolution. Why does this decoy have to be so exquisite? Just a little thing that looked like a worm that can move, like the anglerfish has, would be plenty adequate to lure fish in. Why all this extreme perfection of such a perfect-looking fish? I think God did it to tweak the evolutionists, because even by evolutionist standards, how long would it take for something this good to evolve? At least tens of thousands of years. How do you reproduce in the meantime? Clams don't live tens of thousands of years. And it's so exquisite to show that God is not just the great engineer, he's the great artist. There's nothing too hard for him. He doesn't have to just use a little worm-like thing. He can make an exquisite fish decoy, because with him, all things are possible. Now here we have a couple of jets, 20th century jets, the MiG-21 fish bed and the SR-71 Blackbird reconnaissance aircraft, both supersonic, and they have inlet spikes that regulate how much air can come into the inlet of the jet engine. Because when you're flying at high speed, you get too much air coming in, it can stall the engine and cause a crash. And especially at supersonic speeds, you have to regulate where the supersonic shockwave is manifesting. You want it to manifest back of the inlet and not in it. So, man came up with this idea. We'll put the spike there. It's on a piston that can go in and out to regulate at different speeds how much air can come in. But man didn't invent this first. God invented the inlet spike and put it on the fastest creature in the animal kingdom. That is, of course, the peregrine falcon, which was recently clocked by National Geographic diving at 242 miles per hour, faster than the fastest Indianapolis 500 race car. So, when you're diving that fast, you get too much air in your nostrils, it can be a big problem. But God had the wisdom to invent the inlet spike first, and there it is, right there to keep too much air getting into the nostril of the peregrine falcon. Now, here we have an F-15 Eagle dogfighting with a MiG-29 Fulcrum. And dogfighting doesn't happen very often nowadays because we have missiles that can kill the enemy at beyond visual range. You know, you detect them by radar miles away, fire a missile, and missiles, some of the newer ones like the Meteor, they're not admitting to it, but probably can go over 100 miles. So, very effective. The in-close dogfight just doesn't happen very often anymore, except for one scenario. What if you run out of missiles? Notice on both of these aircraft, there are no missiles left on the pylons on the wings. When you run out of missiles, you have to go fall back on older technology, the gun. And in the F-15 Eagle, you can see the gun smoke coming out of the right wing root. That's where they have its 20-millimeter cannon. And it is a gun so good that although it was invented in the 19th century, it's still used in the 21st century. The man who invented it was named Dr. Gatlin. It is a Gatlin cannon with six multiple barrels that rotate. Now, the old Gatlin cannon, you had to crank, and if you could get 7 or 8 rounds a second, that was pretty good. Well, somebody had the brilliant idea to take that old design and put a powerful electrical motor on it to spin that thing so fast that it would shoot, if it had enough ammunition, it would shoot 6,000 rounds in 1 minute. Now, that computes to 100 rounds per second. Wow. Now, the F-15 only holds 940 rounds, which means if you press down the gun, you have 9.4 seconds of firing and you're out of ammunition. That's plenty. Why? Because when you're shooting 100 rounds per second of APHEI ammunition, armor-piercing high-explosive incendiary, if you get hit with just a few rounds, it'll blow that enemy up. Because they hit like little grenades, they blow up with incendiary force and ignite the fuel. So if the crosshairs happen to just cross through that maneuvering aircraft while the gun is firing, and it's only on target for 1/10 of 1 second, it still gets hit with 10 high-explosive incendiary rounds, enough to take out any modern fighter. That's why when they get in a dogfight, the maneuvering is so violent the opponent knows if he gets to me on target just for a fraction of a second, I'm toast. So they pull incredible G-forces. The problem is in a dogfight, the weakest link in a dogfight is the pilot. The airframe of the aircraft can endure a lot more G-forces than the pilot. The pilot, even with a G-suit, when he starts pulling 9 or 10 Gs, he can usually only maintain that for several seconds at the most, and then the blood drains out of his head and he passes out and either crashes or gets shot down. So even from the days of World War II, they were always trying to find a better G-suit. Now, the current technology is a pneumatic G-suit. In other words, pressurized air is pumped into bladders that squeeze your torso to keep the blood from draining out of your head and push it back up into your head so you don't lose consciousness. Even at that, 9 or 10 Gs, you will lose it. So a Swiss former fighter pilot, retired, Andreas Reinhardt, he said, we got to get something better. And he was smart enough to ask the biomimicry question, has this problem been addressed in the world of biology? And of course it has, as I mentioned before, with the magnificent dragonfly. The dragonfly can dart around with 30 Gs of force and not pass out and crash. How does it do that? Well, in examining the dragonfly, they found that its internal organs, and especially its cardio system, is entirely surrounded with fluid. And that fluid, or that water, dampens the G-forces very effectively just using the known laws of physics. Now, with the best pneumatic G-suit, compressed air G-suit we have today, it's called Combat Edge, invented in the United States, you know, not made in Japan, not made in China, but it cost $100 million taxpayer dollars to invent this thing. It's really just a glorified World War II G-suit, except it has a computer now with special nozzles with a pump, and the computer measures the G-forces and pumps it up or lowers it according to what's happening. They took that, the Combat Edge, and they tested it with top NATO pilots dogfighting, you know, where they're using electronic bullets, but still they want to win, so they dogfight hard. And they tested it against the Lebel G-suit. What does Lebel mean in German? Dragonfly. So the Dragonfly G-suit simply fills those compartments with water and a little alcohol to keep it from freezing if it gets cold. Very simple design, and yet it outperformed the $100 million Combat Edge. Every one of the NATO pilots, after trying both, said, we want the Dragonfly G-suit. With Combat Edge, you know, we can still only pull about 9 or 10 Gs for several seconds, and then, you know, I feel I'm passing out. I got to pull back on the Gs. With the Lebel, I could pull 10 Gs sustained as long as I want, no problem. Tremendous advantage in a dogfight. And when they get done, they say, when I wear the Combat Edge, I'm so exhausted, I can't even get out of the cockpit. I have to call for the crew chief, help me out of the cockpit. I can't get out under my own power. But if I wear the Dragonfly G-suit, I feel great. I feel just exhilarated, no problem at all. So here we have a world-beating design, better than the $100 million research one that we came up with, by a guy who simply asked, how was it done in biology? God had the wisdom to use a much simpler design that's far more effective by using fluid instead of air. God did it first. Now here we have pilots protected by a transparent canopy. Of course, you have to have protection because the wind force when you're traveling at jet speed is tremendous. You could be hit by birds, bird strikes, and if you're flying low, usually it's armored so that it will deflect at least small arms fire. So the idea is you have to have a shield, but you have to be able to look through it. Something to protect you, but it has to be transparent. This kind of a transparent canopy is not something man invented in the jet age. God invented it first, and he did it with, of all things, a fish called the barrel-eyed fish. And we knew known about these fish since the 1930s when they were dragged up in fishing nets, but they're usually always ripped up, and we couldn't really tell what they really looked like. Finally, in just recent years, they got good underwater footage of what the barrel-eyed fish really looks like. And it actually does have a clear canopy to protect its head and its eyes. What does it look like? Well, it looks like that. Now, the mouth is here. These things right here, those are not eyes. Those are nares, the equivalent of underwater nostrils. The eyes are inside the clear canopy here. These green domes, those are the lenses of the eyes. The eyes sit on these barrel-like fixtures that are actually swivels that can swivel all the way up or all the way forward. So the fish usually swims horizontally with its eyes angled up, looking through the canopy. It's looking for the silhouette against the lighted surface of the ocean. is looking for the silhouette of jellyfish. Now, who would want to go after jellyfish? Jellyfish have some of the worst toxins in the world in their stinging tentacles. But this fish is equipped with a clear canopy shield that protects its head, its brain, and its eyes from the stinging cells of those jellyfish. And it could go up and steal dead fish that are entangled in the tentacles of the jellyfish. And when the stinging cells get on this clear canopy, it's immune. So the same concept with our jets. The pilot has to have a clear canopy, a shield to protect him. Well, God thought of that first and put it in the amazing barrel-eyed fish. Now, one of the blessings for modern pilots is called autopilot. You know, you're on a long trip, you just push autopilot, it's tied into GPS, and it will keep you on course. And nowadays, you don't even have to worry about wind drift because the GPS will keep aligning. If the wind is pushing you off course, it keeps calibrating and regulating to get it back on course. But the pilots often make the mistake of sleeping. They shouldn't do that when they put autopilot on, but it's a temptation. Problem is, autopilot is not radar. It will not tell you if there's another aircraft right in front of you that you're going to run into. So if you engage autopilot, don't go to sleep. However, even autopilot is not something man thought of and invented first. God invented it first in his amazing flying creature, the Swift. It has now been proven by tiny little RFID-type chips and computers tracking them that Swifts stay airborne without ever landing for nearly 7 months. Yeah, never touch the ground. Why? Because their food is in the air, insects. If they want to drink, they fly down and skim the surface of a lake without landing. They mate in the air, and the real thing that makes it possible, they sleep while they're flying. And they do it by means of an autopilot. They'll actually fly up nearly 2 miles high, about 10,000 feet, and they'll swim, or not swim, but they'll fly in a lazy circle. And they want to stay over a certain area, usually because it's good hunting, or maybe that's where their nest is. Well, the only reason they ever land is because they rear young. If it weren't for the fact they had to lay eggs in a nest, they wouldn't have to land. Theoretically, if you had something like a confirmed bachelor Swift, he'd never land his whole life. He'd just fly. But they do have to reproduce, they do list, and they do want to stay where their nest is. But during the night, wind can blow them way off course. So they go up about 2 miles high, start this circle over where they want to be, and they shut down half their brain so they can rest. Just like when you're sleeping, your brain isn't completely inoperative, but it does partially shut down to help you rest. Well, it shuts down half its brain, but the half of brain that remains engages an autopilot. And that autopilot causes the bird, while it's sleeping, to sense the wind drift. So when you're going in a circle, when you're going in half that circle, you're facing a headwind. That means you have to speed up a little bit or you're going to be pushed back. But then when it gets the other half of the circle, it's now a tailwind, which means you have to slow down a little bit or you're going to be pushed too far. So while it's sleeping, it's constantly sensing what the wind is doing in that circle, pushing or slowing, it has to speed up or slow down just the right amount, and it's exactly over its nest in the morning, even though it's been sleeping. That's an amazingly effective autopilot. In fact, Johan Bachman, a Lund University Sweden expert in bird navigation, he said, "We have found that swifts have an extraordinary ability to perform orientations in relation to wind. Even the most advanced planes with good navigational instruments would probably be unable to judge the wind drift like this. The remarkable thing is that they do all this while flying through the night and sleeping on the wing at these very high altitudes." So not only did God invent autopilot first, he did it superior to anything that we have in our current technology today. Now, Henry Ford was one of the first to recognize and exploit the virtues of an assembly line. Prior to the assembly line, master craftsmen had to know a lot of different trades and skills, and they'd all work together until they made one car, and it was slow and very expensive. But Henry Ford, he said, you know, if we use an assembly line, then each worker just has to know one skill good. He doesn't have to learn all these other skills, and he just does one job good, and it moves down, and it's fast and efficient, and we can make cars cheap enough that everybody can afford one. And that did come true. But the concept of an assembly line, where you have workers doing a job until you have a finished product, that's nothing new. Nowadays, we have different assembly lines, like this one of this model of Mercedes-Benz in Germany. It has almost all programmed, computerized robots doing almost all the work. very little human involvement. But even this type of an assembly line, where you have programmed robots doing the work, is not something new. God invented it first. Where did he invent it? In the cells of your body, in the metabolic pathways. Krebs' metabolic or citric acid cycle is one of the most important, but there's all kind of precursor metabolic cycles. If we had a chart that filled up half of this ceiling here, they could show you all those prior to this. But it's the same concept. You have a chemical substrate that has to be progressively worked on until you get a finished product at the end of the assembly line. And the things that do those jobs are literally molecular programmed robots called enzymes. And they're more complex than any robot you'll find in a 21st century factory today. God invented it first. Now, here we have the Honda Asimo walking, two-legged walking robot. And it took them decades to finally get it up to where it is now, where it has enough self-awareness and sensors that it can actually walk through a room and not trip over a chair or run into a table. It recognizes obstacles. And it can recognize something like a stair. There's a stairway. It doesn't go, oh, I need to avoid that. It goes, oh, I recognize that's a stairway. It'll go up and walk up the stairs, turn around, and walk back down the stairs. All without remote control, all without being tethered, all by figuring out this stuff itself, because it has a smart enough computer to do that now. Well, that's a pretty amazing achievement, but it's nothing new. God invented it first. You all have two-legged walking robots in the cells of your body by the quadrillions. And if you didn't, you wouldn't be able to live, because they are the transportation trucks, so to speak, in cells that carry proteins to their important destinations. Instead of using trucks to transport them or railroad cars, God uses two-legged walking robots, literally. Now, these two-legged walking robots, called kinesin motor molecules, will attach to a package of a vesicle or a sac of proteins that need to go to a certain destination in the cell. And in the cell, in the eukaryotic cells, like we have in our bodies, they have these microtubules that spread out like a vast highway or freeway system, and you can go to all parts of the cell by walking on that highway system. Well, the things that walk are not trucks, but two-legged robots. If they need a big package, two of them will carry it, otherwise one will do it. They can walk forward and backwards with equal ease. That's something that you don't find in the Asimo. And they're given instructions by the nucleus of the cell. Here's a package of proteins, they need to go to this part of the cell. It gets the instructions, it figures out what highway to go on, what turns to take, and delivers them to the destination. Now, in a eukaryotic cell, which means a cell that has a nucleus enclosed with a membrane and other organelles that appear to have membranes, and those are the type of cells you have in your body, by the way, at this magnification, you can't hardly even see this highway system, because the microtubules are made out of proteins that are only about 15 to 20 nanometers in diameter, and the nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So without a very high-powered scanning electron microscope, you couldn't even see these things. Anyway, what does it look like? Here it is, the kinesin walking robotic molecule. It has arms at the top that attach to the sack of proteins. It has two hinges in its body because it takes off walking real fast and has to bend or it'll break. Kind of like the old proverb, you got to bend with the wind, otherwise you'll break. Well, God put hinges in the body there, and at the bottom, so help me God, there's two little legs with two little feet that walk left to right, right along that microtubule highway. The bottom actually is a separate motor molecule called myosin, and it has two legs and feet that literally walk left, right, down the actin filament, the microtubule, and it's powered by the main energy currency at the cellular level, which is adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. Now, those molecules are floating all around in the matrix of the cell. They're produced by rotary motors, literal rotary motors that produce ATP, different from the rotary propulsion system of the E. coli. So life is based on information that's stored, retrieved, read, and actuated by robotic systems, something we've never seen ever arise without intelligent design. But these ATP molecules are there, so every step it uses one ATP molecule. The amazing thing is it doesn't walk nice and slow like the Honda Asimo. These things regularly take off and go like that, 100 steps per second. Easy, 100 per second. Now, to put that in terms we can understand, what if we took this little robotic molecule and enlarged it until it was the size of a large human being? so that its legs were as big as a large human being, like me. When I walk with a big stride, I can cover 1 yard per stride. So if I were to walk 100 strides in 1 second, I'd be going 100 yards in 1 second. How fast would I be going? In excess of 200 miles an hour. That's proportionately how fast these things would be if we raised them up to the size of a normal robot or a human being. So they go real fast. If we made one big like that, it could go out and compete at the Indianapolis 500 with race cars because it can go faster than 200 miles an hour. God invented it first, and if you didn't have them in your cells, your proteins wouldn't get to where they need to go, and you could not even exist. How do the evolutionists explain this? Well, they don't really. Here we have them walking on the microtubule highway, and just like the Acemo robot, they have situational awareness. These things are coming, you know, 100 steps a second, the equivalent, if they're as big as us, of traveling over 200 miles an hour. So if they're approaching each other, the combined speed would be in excess of 400 miles an hour. You better be able to sense ahead of time there's something coming at you and get out of the way, which they do. They can also walk on the bottom because their feet adhere to it. And they have situational awareness where if damage to the cell happens, say a microtubule is severed, they don't just come up to the end and fall off, you know, like they're just blindly programmed. They have situational awareness. They recognize, oh, the highway is broken. And they don't just stop there and go, gee, now what do I do? They have the equivalent of a cellular GPS that tells them how to get back on target and deliver the product. They start walking backwards at 100 steps a second, just as easily as they walk forward. They go to the nearest intersection. We have all these possible different routes that you could take, and it knows what route to take and the most efficient way to get to the destination. Just like if you go off the freeway, you take a wrong exit, your GPS, you know, starts recalibrating. Okay, turn left on this street, turn right on this street, turn left on this street, because it gets you back on target because it knows where you're going, even if you've never been there before. And these things know where they're going because they have a cellular GPS, better than our best robots today, more complex than our robots today. God invented it first. And yet this astounding level of technology and complexity, when it's confronted by evolutionists, what do they say? Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. In other words, just blindly saying, we're going to believe it no matter what. Well, yeah, but what if the laws of chemistry and physics and mathematics and experimentation shows we never get that type of design ever scientifically except by intelligence? Doesn't matter. No matter what you see, it had to have evolved. It could not have been designed. Well, you know what? Saying it doesn't make it so. Why don't you just put up or shut up? Science, you have to prove what you believe is true by experimentation, or you have to point to proven laws of science that don't change, like chemistry, physics, and mathematics, that show, oh, this has credibility. But the laws themselves make it impossible. It's like when you build a car, it runs according to the laws of chemistry and physics and gravity, etc., but the laws never build the car. The laws can't build the car. The laws prohibit the car from building itself. An intelligent outside force makes it, conceives of it, puts it together, has a blueprint, and, you know, there's information in it. That's how we get these things. It doesn't happen any other way. So I politely tell them, you see this ear? This is not a trash bin. Don't stick your trash in my ear. It's not respectful. Don't just tell me I have to blindly believe what you say. In science, it's like football. You don't show up on the gridiron on Super Bowl day and say, hey, we've arrived, we win, just because we say so. You get out and prove it on the gridiron if you've got the goods. When it comes to proving it, with proven laws of chemistry, physics, and math, and experiments, they utterly fail, cannot do it. We can go in any laboratory any day of the week and prove we can get information by intelligent authorship. We can produce robots that can read that information and build things based on that blueprint. That's the only way it happens. If you can match that, then you would have parity. In other words, you would equal our position. But if you can't even match that, you have nothing. We have all the data scientifically that supports intelligence works. Where is the proof it works any other way? There is none, except this bombastic statement that no matter what you see, it had to have evolved. Well, nanny nanny foo foo, whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you. You know, it's ridiculous. And we need to just say, stop sticking garbage in my ear. I'm a reasonable person. If you've got facts of science, you got laws of chemistry, laws of physics, laws of math, and especially experiments that show that what you're saying is true, I'm willing to listen. But it appears to me you have nothing and you're trying to just use bombast and browbeating and calling us names if we don't agree with you, as if that's scientific evidence. It is not. And they're going to have to face that, whether they like it or not, because when we look at this level of technology, and we've only looked at a few today, it outstrips anything in human technology. It shows a greater intelligence, a greater power than man could ever match. And God says that leaves them without excuse. As it says in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, "For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made, his handiworks." Well, today we've looked at just some of his marvelous handiworks that God thought of first and that we can at best only copy. "And therefore men are altogether without any defense or justification." You know, on the judgment day, Charles Darwin, I think, will have more lenience than his cohorts today. Darwin could plead a lot of ignorance. You know, the Bible says if men sin, not knowing so much what they're doing, they'll be beaten with few stripes. In other words, they'll have a less severe punishment. But those who know full well what they're doing and still do it, they will be beaten with many stripes. They get a more severe punishment. Well, Darwin could say, "Oh, God, have a little lenience. After all, I didn't know about DNA, RNA, ribosomes, proteins. I didn't know about all this stuff Dr. Kendall talked about today. It was unknown in the middle of the 1800s. Yeah, there was plenty he knew that he did reject, but he didn't know what we know today. What are his contemporaries today going to say? "Oh, God, be lenient. We didn't know anything." They know more than has ever been known by scientists in the history of the world. "And to whom much is given, of the same shall much be required." And they do worse than that. Like Jesus said of the Pharisees, "You not only refuse to enter the kingdom of God yourselves, you try to hinder those who are willing to enter. And for that, you will have the greater judgment." So pray for these evolutionists. Pray for Stephen Hawking. He surely doesn't have much longer. But he gets up there and says, "Oh, there's no God, because I'm so smart. I figured out everything came from nothing." Brilliant. Yes, you know. It's sad. It is truly sad. But the battle is for our children. They're told in our culture from cradle to grave, evolution is a fact. You don't need to believe in God. You don't need to believe in the Bible. God says quite different. You're without excuse. Think for yourself. Don't be told what to believe. Check it out for yourself, because on the judgment day, you're not going to be able to point fingers at other people. Study. Show yourselves approved unto God. The scripture says, "Give an answer to every man who asks you a reason for the hope that's within you. Earnestly contend for the gospel in these last days." And one of the major attacks has been at the foundation of creation. If Genesis 1:1 is not true, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," then nothing else in the Bible can be true. You knock down that first verse, everything goes. The enemy knows that. That's why they attack creation so much today. Because if there is a God, we're accountable. And they don't want to be accountable. Simple as that. He's a loving God. He doesn't want to judge them. He doesn't want them to be separated from him. But he has this horrible law that they just can't live with. "Thou shalt love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself." In our hearts, we know that's true. We were designed and created for love. But the richest, most powerful, most influential people in the world, I'll tell you, did not get there by loving God and loving their neighbor as themselves. They climbed over whoever they had to, in whatever way they had to get that kind of power, and they don't want to give it up. They love the pleasures of sin. They don't want to give it up. And so God becomes their worst nightmare. Well, if they want to reject God and go into eternity without him, that's their prerogative. They're made in the image of God. They have the dignity of free choice. But why do they have to take our children on the broad path to eternal ruin? Well, because they're under the power of the devil that they don't even believe in. And that's what the devil wants, to kill and steal and destroy. His most successful lie has been evolution. So let us study. Let us earnestly contend for the gospel. Let us refute the gainsayers. Now, the Bible says not to ignore them, to refute them. Why are we in this big trouble with evolution today? Our fundamentalist founders, forefathers, back in the days of Darwin said, "Oh, it's a crazy theory. Nothing will ever come of it." They didn't bother to refute it. They didn't contend with it. They didn't try to suppress it and destroy it with the truth. They just let it have free reign. And look at where we are today. We have to earnestly contend for the scripture, give an answer, and refute the gainsayers, not ignore them. And more so today than ever. And start with your children. We're losing 2/3 of our children from the church. I mean, that's horrific attrition. And of all places, if they can't hear the truth in the church, where are they going to hear it? Thank God for your pastor. There are many churches that will not even play one of my videos. "Oh, creation is too controversial. We can't have that in our Sunday school." Really? Why don't you just get out of the army of the Lord? Why don't you just stop following Jesus Christ, the most controversial man who ever lived in history, if you're wanting to avoid controversy? Why don't you give up the deity of Christ, virgin birth, and the resurrection? That's very controversial. Why don't you give that up too? You see, once you start giving it up, the people you want the praise from are not going to be satisfied till you give it all up. So why not just not give any of it up? We want the praise of God, not the praise of man. Amen. Well, I've gone too long. God bless you. I do have this available on DVD, both part one that I've done today and part two, which is all different examples, but extremely important and good also. I've run out of these because I've been on the road for 7 weeks. I'll get back home next week. But if you want to sign up for it and prepay, then I'll ship it to you free of shipping and handling, so it won't cost you any more than if you got it here. Anyway, Pastor Rick, we'll turn it over to you. Thank you so much for your attention today.